This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 411 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So it's not going to be timely by the time you guys hear this. However, since we last recorded, there is a wee annoncement from production. Do we want, well, it is an announcement. It's a basically a confirmation of what has already been, quote unquote, allowed to be leaked anonymously to the press by various who knows sources. Do you want to say what that is?
I mean, we already knew that they were planning a prequel, but we didn't know what the prequel was. And there's a lot of conversation around what does prequel mean. But that being said, it is going to be the Brian and Ellen story, the book that hasn't been written yet.
My name is Ellen. Well, she's working on it. She's working on it. She has said she has worked on it. Maybe not whole hog, but it has been in development for probably 2 decades. Like, it's not a new thing that it's not new to Diana.
No, just the book doesn't exist yet.
It doesn't exist, but she has been working on it. Even if it's not, like I said, whole hog. What we do know is that, well, we don't know exactly. We don't know when this, all that was greenlit is, excuse me, all that was announced or officialized, I guess, is that they confirmed the development and what the development was of a TV series about Brian and Ellen. That's all we know. Because I was reading an article or a few articles back when it was announced, and it said, it didn't even promise it was going to happen. It was basically confirming the development of, like, putting feelers out. Like, it's almost like we're a confirmation that, yes, we're confirming. It was almost like baby steps before you even get any kind of announcement, right?
It's like the ring you get before a promise ring, promising that you'll think about getting engaged at a later date.
No, thinking about you might get another promise ring, which then would absolutely promise that you should get engaged one day. Absolutely. So it's still a big change, though, because Stars does not say things unless they mean them, typically. And that's why
they know where their money is to be made. They did the same thing with Power. There's like 4 different Power shows now. And
it's called Power Book or something.
I don't know. It's a lot. But it's not surprising. That seems to fall in line with their MO.
So that's the quote unquote only announcement we have. But again, by the time you guys hear this from us, it is not only old news right now today, a few weeks old anyway. It will be a lot older news by the time you hear this. But trying to make sure we don't miss them. This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Catherine H.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with Chapter 7 entitled An Uncertain Future.
So when I first, because it's been a little minute since I've looked at it. And so when I read it, and we're still pretty darn close to the beginning of the book, I was like, wait, did we already... I mean, I know I've read it like years ago. I know that. That's not a question. But like, haven't we already talked about this? But no. The reason it seemed like we talked about it was because the chapter opens with the time and place, you know, the setting. Lallybroch, Scotland, 1980. Okay, that's not new to us. We're back again. And they're talking about letters. And that's kind of how the book started between chapters 1 and 2 or something like that. So I was like, wait, have we already done this? No. It is more talk, and they do read a letter, but it's not... It's not what we have covered before. But the thing that still gets me is that all the stuff that goes down, I've talked about it several times before, all the stuff that goes down, mainly for the Mackenzies, between now or beginning of 7 and the end of 8, I think it's the freakiest, most mysterious part of the entire series thus far, meaning through book 9. Because who knows? Book 10, I don't know. I think as stuff, because we know it did not have there's more development in 9, but in 10, if it's truly the last one, a lot of stuff / everything, maybe hopefully, should be like not ratified, not finalized, developed and finished. So, you know, it answers wrapped up basically, right? All your questions or most of your questions are answered, you hope. I know we're not we don't have 10 yet, so there's nothing to talk about. But I think even getting questions answered, and even with what we have in 9, which began that process, especially toward the latter half of 9, it's still not as exciting or as, for me, thrilling or as kind of spooky, mysterious. I think the spooky, mysterious parts between is mostly 8, maybe a little bit of 7, but mostly 8. To me, that is a bigger, like, emotional roller coaster as a reader, more intense than the stuff in 9, even though 9 is intense and 9 kind of goes to answer, not answer questions, but gives you some ideas that maybe some questions are about to be answered.
9 started a whole new storyline.
Well, oh, well, not 9 is its own thing, but correct. But toward the second half, it just, it makes you like basically start second guessing almost everything, right? In certain times. So we're still in Scotland. We're still with the Mackenzies. They're looking at the letters left to them by the Frasers. Bree chooses one dated March 2nd, 1777. She says it was rather brief, although it didn't seem that brief. Jamie wrote it, and he's updating them on the state of the battles in the colonies at the time and how they, the Frasers, plan to go to Scotland for a relatively short time.
Do you think she chose to go with Jamie's letter first because she knew he was going to be succinct?
Well, she didn't know it was by him.
Well, it was short. And it being short indicated that it had to do with his difficulty writing.
She didn't know who wrote it until she opened it, and then it made sense why it was short, or I guess not as thick, because it was not as a thick letter, I guess. I don't know. My guess is it was the next one on in the row. And one thing I did not say, but that is in there, if I'm not mistaken, is the date of the letters are on top, so you don't have to open it to see when it was written. So it's possible that. My guess is if they're going to date them, probably the Frasers put them in reverse chronological order. So when they open the box, they would be able to see, you know. Now, we don't know this yet. I don't think it really spoils much, if anything, but we don't know this yet. But in their plan to get these letters, which is a whole other smorgasbord, to the safely to the 20th century, multiple copies had to be made. So Jamie might have written this. But does that mean that he wrote all, say, if they had 3 copies or 2 copies and an original, did he write the other 2? Who knows? It could have been Claire, because he dictates to her often. So that would not be out of the question. So yeah, but definitely this one is written by him. And he says there are 2 reasons that they are choosing to go to Scotland relatively briefly. And those are to get his printer, to bring it back with him, and to take young Ian home.
And also, no time like the present. We don't have a house anyway. Might as well.
Yeah, but they could have gone where to be with or settled around.
No, but they haven't. But you're right. But they didn't.
Well, they didn't, and that was one of the reasons that they gave that they wanted to get their printer was because he didn't think his presence in basically what's his name, not Claudel, Fergus. Fergus, because of what he was already doing, right? Like, say, printing potential seditious stuff, right? Fergus was already had some kind of like potential target on his back. He did not need more. And so they decided that it didn't make sense for them to, you know, stay with them or stay around them or for too long, let alone settle. And so so they never said they weren't going back to the Ridge, but they did know that they... Kind of, yeah. It's like, well, our lives here have ended in this way right now. There's really, why not? Like, there's no house to worry about being broken into.
Right.
May as well go. But yeah, I do think it's both. They have absolute goals and targets and needs, but you're right. The timing is just like, why not? Like, there's no better time. Like, if you're ever wondering for a time, the universe is telling you now. In the letter, Jamie had also made a remark about being what God made him. Now, we know that what he's referring to and what Diana constantly refers to or consistently refers to is he's a leader of men, right? He can't not be that. And so that is also, I think, implied here that they're not going, another reason why they're not going to Scotland to stay, because while they absolutely would be welcome there at Lallybroch and they could stay, he still is in potential danger in Scotland, right? Because he left on not so great terms. He left Edinburgh to go to Lallybroch and then, you know, took off to try and find his kidnapped nephew. So, but when they left, remember, there were people after him, right? They were hiding out and he was doing nefarious stuff. So he has his own, or had his own, target on his back when he left Scotland that time. So it's not in the cards for them to stay in Scotland. And he's a leader of men. Even if they were safe at Lallybroch long term, it's not his place anymore. He signed it over, and that's good because it saved the place. It saved the family. The family, you know, maybe lives were saved because they had shelter. They were not kicked out of their home. So Jamie, being this leader of men, even if he were physically safe there, it would have kind of eaten him alive. Not that he wasn't laired there. No, he's not an asshole. But he wouldn't have been able to fulfill. He would have gotten antsy in the pantsy. He would not have been able to fulfill his role. He would have been itching to find a way to lead people, because that is him. No matter where he ends up, where he goes, even to freaking prison, he ends up as a leader. So he knew, they knew that, for a number of reasons, but that one was a big one, that they would not be settling, at least at Lallybroch. So meanwhile, while this is kind of information we're getting from the letter, Jem is showing Mandy here, because again, remember, they're at Lallybroch. Jem is showing Mandy the saber marks of the bad English that they had done during the rising. And this is what, of course, happened after Culloden. It's what had been told to young Ian by Elder Ian. And now young Jem is telling his sister. So it's keeping on a tradition.
And that was chapter 7. Moving right along to chapter 8. This one is entitled Spring Thaw.
Now we go from 20th century Lallybroch,
Scotland. We should just call this chapter Shrinkage.
I mean, that was one thing that happened.
It happened constantly. Like, they were constantly talking about penises and balls and shriveled and muscles and cold and spring baths. Like, it was like, and then she goes over to the house where he's moving poles around and he's sitting there naked. I mean, it's like, there's just a lot of nakedness in this chapter, but not really sexual, just nakedness.
So we go from 20th century Scotland to 18th century North Carolina. Fraser's Ridge, March, so same month, March 1777. Excuse me. We were not given a month of the 20th century, but the letter they were reading was March 2nd, 1777. So while we don't have a date here, we have a month and a year. I mean, it's either on the day, or it's definitely around the day, but it's at least the same month. The letter that they were just reading was written. And so now that this is an example, we don't get a ton of it, but this is pretty spot on. Do you note how time is passing? This is an example of the parallel passage of time. They're reading, okay, it's not March 1980. No, I'm not saying that. But they're reading the letter that was written at the same time that we get flashback to. Or not even flashback. This is the actual story, but we're now in the 18th century. So this is as kind of, I would say the parallel, probably the most parallel story we get is probably Voyager, because you're getting Claire's story while you're getting Jamie's story. That's a little bit more parallel, even though it's not perfectly parallel. This is maybe the next, quote unquote, next best thing to as parallel. I remarked on this in an earlier chapter, but as I see it, I might, I'll try and keep track of this, because at some point it does stop. So like I'm saying, when we get the Mackenzie is reading a letter, and then the story, the book, goes to, in the next chapter or half the chapter or whatever, it goes to the Ridge or wherever the Frasers are. It is in this book, it's a lot of kind of picking up where I left off, picking up where we left off, right? So we'll get a letter, the Mackenzies will be reading a letter, and right after that letter ends, or Diana stops it, and then we do, the next time we pick up on the next page, the next paragraph, whatever it is, we pick up with the 18th century Frasers. They're in the exact same situation that was just talked about in the letter we read. So she does a lot of this, and obviously it helps move the story forward a little quicker. So Jamie and Claire on the Ridge, they're prepping to pack and leave for the coast and then on to Scotland. We know the house was destroyed in the fire, but Diana describes just how little is left. specifically of Claire's surgery and stuff. Out of a few odds and ends, or pieces of odds and ends, only one recipe of Dr. Rawlings survives. And that's, I did not write it down what it was, but it was something that she had actually found helpful and effective. She also still had only had one scalpel and a small amputation blade, which she remarked that Jamie would be able to make her a new handle for. Not a lot. We knew this. We knew the fire was bad, but it's kind of interesting that she was, you know, able to save a few things.
I mean, usually, unless the whole thing is like, the whole thing is burnt, there's usually able to save some things.
Well, the whole thing was burnt. It was burnt to the ground. There wasn't like a frame left. But obviously there were like the things that she found. Well, I can't speak for the piece of paper. Maybe it flew out the window. I don't know. Because it was kind of charred around. The other things that were left were metal. And that makes sense, right? Metal, it takes a much higher, they have a higher melting point than, say, paper. Residents, now since they were, first of all, everyone knows the house is gone. And they also know that they're, that they've decided to make their way to the coast and go on a journey. So the residents of the Ridge, some residents had have been very generous in giving them stuff to help them, whether it was clothing or you know, accoutrement, whatever they had, because most of their stuff was, again, lost in the fire. So one thing they did have was plenty of alcohol. Now, it was new or, you know, very high percentage, high proof alcohol, because it was like raw, almost raw alcohol, because the corn crib had not been destroyed in the fire. So Jamie had turned a lot of the corn into a strong but raw liquor that they would take for trade. Claire asks Jamie, she's thinking about, I did not write what her thought process was. I don't know. I did not write down what made her think of this or what the paragraph was before this or what led to this, but she asks Jamie how white her hair is. So we know this is in regard to Nyawene and her potential power. And we find out from Jamie that he says, oh, one in 20 and is gray and one in 10 is white. I don't know, whatever. He does something funny like that. So basically the answer is no, it's not all white yet. She's not there yet. We find out what's happened to the gold. Once they'd realized where it was under the house, right? They knew that they had to do something with it. They couldn't take it with them. Obviously, there's too much. But they also didn't want it to be found or taken by others, including Archbug. Heck, they didn't want anyone to even have knowledge of the gold. Because even though they truly did not have those gems, when... who's the TT?
Donner.
Yeah, Donner. Because what caused the fire, right? It was Donner's ass. So basically, or Donner and his people. So Donner and his little miscreant friends, the reason they came to the Ridge is because, well, yes, he time travel, yes, and she mentioned gems and all that. It was because of the thought of, or the rumor, however you want to look at it, that the Frasers on the Ridge had gems. And yes, it did not help that Claire talked about it, right? That she, not that she had them, but that their relation to time travel and everything. So due to whatever Donner got up his butt nut, he was able to convince people that, hey, there's a stash of gems up there, a cache of gems up there. And all we got to do is go up there and we can find them, or maybe they'll share, whatever. So obviously that was a thing that led to the explosion, the house burning, the house fire. And it would be just as bad, if not worse, if there was even a hint of a rumor that there was gold somewhere on the Ridge.
Well, gold is even easier to move than jewels.
Of course, absolutely, because gold, you can, I mean, you may, if you're like, you know, not dressed really well, or people might give you side eye for carrying gold, like if you take it into a bank or whatever it is. It's a lot easier to get cash for that, absolutely, than for a gem. Because you're right. Jamie and Bobby McFarland. No, what's his name? Bobby Higgins. Jamie, at least once, sent a few gems or at one point along with Bobby Higgins to, when he was like the back and forth before he stayed on the Ridge, to Lord John. And Jamie asked Lord John to turn them into money, basically, right? Sell them, whatever he needed to do. Because yeah, you got to be on the ball. So while gems are a convenient, easy way to carry them, to carry riches because they're not as heavy as gold, let's be honest. Gold is more socially, I don't want to say acceptable. Gold is, you're right, easier to monetize, easier to turn into cash. But yeah, so even the rumor of gold on the ridge, it's not just that it would bring in looky-loos. It would be really dangerous for people not in the know. It would be dangerous for any of the ridge dwellers, right? It's not safe. So they knew that they had to do something with the gold. They couldn't take it with them, but they had to figure something out. They decided to move it bit by bit. And it took 2 weeks because they only worked at night and only when fresh snow was falling or would cover their tracks.
That is like such a, I mean, it makes sense, but when you hear it the first time, you're like, that is ridiculous slow conditions.
Oh, I know. And they couldn't even work together. I mean, they technically were together, but one had to do the moving and one had to stay behind at the stash place at yeah. the house to make sure that no one saw what they were doing, to basically guard the gold, guard the remains of the big house. Remains of the big house. I wrote that down. So maybe there were little pieces of wood here and there. I don't know. So the decision as to where to hide it was kept between Jamie and Ian. But Diana tells us it was the Spaniard's cave. So the plan was, so they used the nighttime and the snow to move the gold. Once spring arrived and the snow began to melt, Claire was out collecting greens in a, of course, cold stream. And this time she is surprised by the screams of males. Their bits all cold as they take a dip in the freezing waters. So that's a neat scene. I can't imagine, as long as it's not like too young of little kids, because obviously you can't have like child nudity, but that could be something I could see them filming if they wanted. I mean, I think it would be cute.
Do you think it's going to be like Room with a View?
Oh, maybe.
Where all the men are just like running around naked and jumping into the lake.
Except this is just Jamie and Bobby and a lot of kids.
Doesn't Ian show up?
Oh, yeah. And Ian. So maybe the three of them with maybe like a 10-year-old kid or something. But you can't do little, I don't know. I don't know how much they would show of a little boy. We may not get any peenies, but we may just get butts, and that's fine.
I mean, it's a shame Tobias isn't in this scene. We would have definitely got peen.
You mean beer can?
I mean peen.
Yeah, beer can peen.
It's not that big, Ginger. It's a penis.
Okay, sorry. So after she sees her seas and they leave the area, or after the boys, the men, whatever, leave the area, Claire meets Jamie at the site of what is known as New House, even though there's no house yet, where for now, it's just some logs that have been laid out in an outline. They're there together. Claire does a job and then they do a job. And then she falls asleep. And when she wakes up, Jamie's gone, but she finds him at the spring, at a spring, not the place where they swam earlier, but at a spring where she's seen him, I think only once before. He goes there to do or to ruminate or to think about big, important things. He was praying, consorting with spirits, what have you. And she hears him say, "Let me be enough." And he does his thing. As he's leaving, she meets up with him there. So a few days later, as she's like spending a lot of time in the water. As she's collecting leeches, Jamie says he'll show her the Spaniard's cave. It was about 4 miles from the ridge. Oh my gosh, just stop right there. Imagine working by night on your own. Because again, one person's staying back to guard the ridge and the gold. The ridge, the house and the gold. You got to take whatever your burden is, whatever you're carrying, 4 miles one way in the dark, down the hole, up to the little area where things are. I mean, we're going to get to that in a second. But the heck? I hope there was a moonlight, because you can't bring a torch with you.
In the snow.
That's what I just said. In the dark.
At night.
Active snow.
I mean, that's...
Good gracious.
Okay, if it's 4 miles, I could... And I'm not laden down with anything. I could probably do 4 miles in an hour.
It's kind of trucking it.
And that's if it's flat and I'm not like weighed down. But they're carrying gold. Gold is heavy.
Heavy, yes.
So you have to imagine the person who's sitting at the cave watching it. It's just sitting there in the cold. At least the guy who's
sitting
walking
at the cave
is warming up.
Or you mean sitting at the house?
Yeah, wherever the okay. Where the, yeah.
I was like, oh my Lord, did I miss somebody waiting at the cave?
No.
So it's 4 miles one way. Jamie tells Claire how they found it. Quote, "We found it, Jem and I, out hunting one day. It was a secret between us. We'd agreed we'd tell no one, not even his parents," unquote. And so that gives you some, and that's true even in the 20th century. So Jem has not told his parents. Quote, "The entrance to the cave was a crack in the ground over which Jamie had pushed a large flat rock. He slid.
Mm-mm.
I think it's he slid. Probably slids. Slids? Oh my.
Wow.
He slid this back with some effort. And I bent.
Lady.
This is my writing. This isn't even me talking fake. I'm reading what I'm writing and it's bad. And I bent over cautiously. Oh my God, Summer, it's again. Experiencing.
Wow.
Balls. You. Experiencing a brief clench of the innards at the faint sound of moving air through the fissure, unquote. Yes, it sounds like someone's trying to hold in a fart.
Poetic.
Well, I mean, I guess. So this reminds Claire of the cave at Abandawe, however you say it. It's said different ways. It was about this cave, because they're actually going down in it. This cave was about 10 to 12 feet in depth. They both enter it. Jamie lights a taper and she sees the Spaniard and they talk about what may have killed the Spaniard, why he couldn't have escaped, whether he was murdered down there or whether he were just injured and he couldn't get back up this ladder, whatever. And it was when he and Jem were there that they saw the marks in the sand that hinted that there may have been boxes or who knows, treasure stored there once upon a time. And that is what made Jamie think of hiding the gold there. So that is how we got to, he decided to hide the gold in the cave.
And that was chapter 8, Spring Thaw. Join us next time when we will be discussing chapter 9, A Knife That Knows My Hand, and chapter 10, entitled Fire Ship.
Again, a special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Catherine H. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in joining the conversation and, you know, continuing to talk about the book when we're not on, please join us online at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.